The clothes seem boring, and since I'm on a student budget, expensive. It would take me years to realize that boring and expensive were the twin sartorial goals in lawyer.
Welcome to Rebalancing Act. I'm Leslie Ann Saintmore, and I'm here with Kieran Waterhouse. We know Canada has to solve climate change, and so let's talk about how to do that. This week, we're talking about resource economies.
How are you, Leslie Ann?
I'm doing well. And how are you doing, Kieran?
I'm doing good. Trying to have, you know, I feel like Mondays are either a nothing day or an everything day. And I'm trying to have an everything day. A productive Ooh. Everything day.
Ooh. Mm-hmm. Bold. I don't know if I can ever have an everything day on a Monday. I don't think it ever comes together for me like that.
That's fair. My eyes are just wide with aspirations.
I love that for you. I love it. Love it. Okay. Before we get into this episode, we are going to be discussing a word that is spelt a way that I, as a Canadian, want to pronounce as the French would. And I had to Google the appropriate way to pronounce this word. Because I swear in my undergrad, it was not pronounced rentier.
No.
But rentier. I Googled, and apparently it can be pronounced rentier.
Huh.
So.
French, the language of diplomacy.
I even specifically clicked the American pronunciation. And it was like, rentier. And I'm like, that is incorrect for the American pronunciation. But I appreciate this validation.
So wait, what is it, Leslie Ann? What is a rentier? Or I think it's actually rentier.
A rentier state is like the way we'll be talking about it. And it is where a state basically gets all of its revenue from rent, in quotation marks, air quotes, paid by, you know, foreign governments or foreign individuals or companies. And the reason I air quoted rent is because it's not rent in the way, you know, you lease an apartment and you pay rent, but rather it's the use of a natural resource or land in the company or in the country. So, for example, an oil company that is extracting oil, refining it, and then exporting it would be paying rents to the country that owns that oil under the ground. Does that make sense?
I think so. And just to clarify, states, not the United States. I feel like that's poli-sci speak for countries. So countries
Don't even
that,
get me into it.
Countries that are... They have a lot of natural resources, and they're relying on them in order to fund their economy in a pretty, like, resource-heavy way. This isn't, like, a 30% situation.
No, it's where they are primarily funded by that resource. And so, you know, examples that are relatively common tend to be oil countries, or countries that are heavily reliant on certain minerals. You sometimes see that in parts of Africa. But we'll primarily be talking about it in terms of oil and natural gas dependency.
What makes that different from, like, food? If you are producing a specific food commodity, like something that can only be grown in one part of the world. I'm just curious.
In some ways it doesn't, in some ways it does. So what I was going to add is that, so for example, there's four general characteristics of a rentier state. And one of them is that only a small portion of the working population are actually involved in the generation of the rent, of the income. And in some countries where it is very food-based, I think you have a larger working population that's reliant and involved in that industry. And so the dynamic created by a government reallocating the income to individuals doesn't exist in the same way. because individuals are being paid for their role in that resource economy. But
so interesting.
There are examples of rentier states that have been based on a food. For example, I low-key am super uncomfortable with the store Banana Republic because of its name. It's just weird and gross and, like, unnecessary.
Mm-hmm.
Because a Banana Republic is a term for a country that is, you know, thought to be unstable and is based upon the exportation of a resource. And it was originally used to talk about Honduras and neighboring countries when they were dealing with exploitation from U.S. companies. And in particular, in Honduras, it was a company that was exporting bananas that dominated the economy of Honduras. And so Banana Republic's kind of a derogatory term for a country.
Yeah, they're saying you're not a real country. I feel like it's an implication that your country is, like, not functional.
That you're politically unstable or that you're undemocratic. And, you know, I've looked this up before because in law school and as a young lawyer, Banana Republic is often suggested as, like, the place to go buy, like, business attire that's relatively affordable for young lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
And I just hate the name of it. And so I did one day actually Google, why is it called that? And apparently before it was bought by Gap, it actually sold, like, safari-themed clothing.
Wild. Colonial vibes.
Yeah, it was blatantly meant to be named after a Banana Republic. Because they were selling, like, refashioned army surplus, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Which did not make me feel better about the name at all. I was, like, hoping it was going to be some sort of story where, like, it was originally unrelated. And, like, now it just sounds bad. But no, it was just bad from the beginning and no one's changed it.
Yep. The cultural context that let that happen is a lull.
And it's wild. And I'll drop this article in the show notes because I just think it's also funny because it's written by a lawyer who also is just like, people would tell me Banana Republic was basic, but also it was still $130 for a blazer and I could not afford it. And I'm like, mood.
That is mood. Wait, I want to read it. I can record my reaction to it.
Yes.
Catapult. Yeah. Ooh, the forgotten history of Banana Republic. Why do stores still have that insulting name? That's very true. Banana Republic is one of those places that people think it's fancy, so they go and they're snobby about it. And it is kind of expensive, but it's not that nice.
Yeah. I'm really loving this live reaction to this article.
I am so glad. The clothes seem boring, and since I'm on a student budget, expensive. It would take me years to realize that boring and expensive were the twin sartorial goals in lawyer land. Accurate.
Yeah.
Not a great name for a store. Also, not a great situation for a country to be in. I feel like that makes a country extremely vulnerable. Its ceiling was painted, the original Banana Republic ceiling was painted to resemble a quote-unquote blue Zimbabwean sky.
Right? Huh. Like, huh. Specifically Zimbabwe.
So Banana Republic's bad store, not a great situation for a country to be in.
Well, you gotta get to the part about the Bombay shirt dress.
I believe that it's a bad time. A Bombay shirt dress is deemed necessary because it's still the dark ages for women in much of the world. No pants, no shorts, no like it, go home. A French West African hat was invented between now and then. Some former French colony suffered a trifling rebellion or economic collapse. And France, for old time's sake, sent troops or financiers to help restore order. Gallic lads who'd never suffered a stronger sun than that of Saint-Tropez. Huh. So, I mean, makes me feel like, you know, obviously a colonial store, and also, I guess, you know, similarly a colonial country as well, or a colonial situation for countries to be in. I feel like there's a lot of geopolitics involved.
Yeah. And it's wild to me that, like, it's not only us who associate Banana Republic with, like, the beginning of being a lawyer and buying clothes. And yet, I've never heard anyone acknowledge how weird the name is and how colonial it is and how, please, Banana Republic / Gap, please don't come after us for this. It's nothing that's not already out there. But, like, come on.
Totally. Yeah. They can do better. So tell me more about the resource curse of being a Banana Republic lesbian.
I will, including the fact that, you know, it's wild. It's what? Not only humans that do this.
That is wild.
Bacteria do this too.
Huh.
The things I did not know I had in common with bacteria, right?
Mm-hmm. So I feel like we have a lot in common with bacteria. Aren't we made out of bacteria?
I think bacteria lives on us. So I guess we do have a lot in common. I guess we share the same skin in different ways. Maybe that should not be in the podcast. But they've done research on how bacteria react to high and low levels of resources. And it's interesting that when resources are high, bacteria populations tend to be more competitive and aggressive. And ecological studies will show that it's often where there's a lot of resources, you have species that have reproductive strategies where it's based on short time before sexual maturity, many offspring, short pregnancies, less parental care. For example, like, huh. The only thing coming to mind is spiders right now, or fish.
Interesting.
Versus where there's low resource levels, and you have longer life expectancy, fewer offspring, more care from parents, think maybe bears, the populations are more cooperative. And they think it's because you get these cooperative behaviors, you know, the raising of the young, the less reproduction rates, because individuals of a species are more likely to die from environmental selection. And so populations in hostile conditions are selected to be cooperative. Whereas in competitive environments where there's a lot of resources, competition is less likely, environmental factors are less likely to be the cause of death, and it tends to be those who are more competitive succeed. And it's wild that this happens with bacteria, other species as well, and humans have just kind of gone on to do it in a slightly different way with what we deemed to be important resources. And so it makes me wonder, like, what in the nature of living creatures does this, and how... What is human nature versus, like, what is bear nature versus what is spider nature, and why are they so similar?
Well, I just feel like at the end of the day, my observation of human action is, like, we do wait for, you know, it's easy to take the easy solution. And I feel like when you're in a country that has large reserves of fossil fuels, especially if they're easily extractable, that is just the easy way out. You have this really valuable global commodity, and then in, you know, you are in a power structure, if you are the person that owns that resource, you're in a great position to solidify your own power. So it just makes sense to me that people out there do that, and that to avoid having that occur, you need such strong democratic institutions that are going to push against that, and that just doesn't happen as often.
Definitely. And that's what a lot of folks call the resource curse, and the way that there's some evidence, I say some because there's conflicting studies on this, but there is some evidence that supports a relationship between number of resources and armed conflicts, political instability, And some of the factors behind this are the ideas of, wealth may increase vulnerability of countries to conflict by undermining the quality of the governance and economic performance. Conflicts might occur over who gets to control the resource. And another one that's really interesting, and one that I've thought a lot about lately, is also conflict can be extended and prolonged by access to a resource. For example, in parts of Latin America, in Colombia, during the Civil War, some of the rebel groups got involved in the drug trade as a way to fund their rebellion. And that enabled them to continue to fight. So it's kind of interesting how it's not only the resources that can cause the conflict, but it's also simply that they can extend them. And while I said that it's a mixed bag of the strength of this relationship, there's research showing that oil in particular lowers the level of democracy and can strengthen autocratic rule in a country. And it's the only resource that has been consistently correlated with less democracy.
So interesting. Again, it makes sense. I feel like, for example, if you have a knowledge economy or even just an economy that requires a lot of people in your country to work together, you just need a certain level of buy-in in order to do something, and people will react quickly if things aren't going the way that they want. Whereas I just feel like, one of the things that is a blessing and a curse of resources and fossil fuel resources that you don't, it doesn't take that many people to hold on to them and to keep on using them to fund whatever projects or schemes they have.
Exactly. And folks are receiving the benefits of that money, whether it be directly or through social services, and they aren't paying taxes to provide these services. It alters the social contract between people. It alters the expectations. There's the idea of no taxation without representation, but it can also be no representation without taxation. And so the expectations of your government are different when that power only goes one way.
Yeah, I don't think that they have taxation. I don't think they have income tax in Saudi Arabia. And also, most of
No.
the population works for Aramco. So they work for the government and they work in line, I guess, with the fossil fuel extraction.
Yeah, and many of these countries that are considered rentier economies, that's one of the principles, is that the government is the primary recipient of the revenue, and then the economy relies on the government redistributing that money, that income. And it's not always done equally. It's often the elite who have a really strong pull on the government because they're tied to these foreign companies, foreign countries, foreign individuals who are doing the business. But it's because the working population isn't involved in the basis of the economy, their income, their economic participation is often coming from the government, whether it be direct or through services.
So interesting. So is, I guess the reason why we are talking about this is because of the impact and the geopolitical dynamics that have happened from Russia's invasion of Ukraine. That there is a huge global interconnected vulnerability there because so many people are dependent on Russia's supply of oil and of natural gas, and how it does actually create this interconnectedness and it makes it more difficult to engage in other political arenas, when you rely on somebody for your oil and for your natural gas. And like, those are things that the nature of energy planning is long term. You can't plan your way out of that in a crisis. So it does really create a level of, I think, unwanted or unwelcome interdependence.
I think you're right, and it's challenging because I think for a long time we've seen the countries that had oil reserves that were involved in geopolitical maneuvers often weren't such a large supplier for so many people involved. Whereas I find with, I think with Russia, because of where it is located geographically and the parties involved, it is really a big impact on folks. Whereas I think about Venezuela, for example, where, you know, there have been a variety of different sanctions on Venezuela for many years, and that includes Venezuela's oil industry. But while Venezuela was a large oil producer and their economy was heavily reliant on it, my impression was always that it didn't supply, it wasn't a key supplier for the same diversity of nations as Russia is, and that it was easier for countries to break away from Venezuela's oil. Not that all have, but it was easier. Whereas I get the impression now with Russia, it's going to be a bigger challenge, and that's not good. I don't say that to take a stance on, you know, the best way to do sanctions or how to navigate that, because there's a lot of issues there politically, but because, you know, there's something people call the carbon curse, and how countries that have a lot of fossil fuel resources, it's more difficult for them to take climate action. And so if we continue to rely on countries that know they can rely on our need for their oil, what's the incentive for them to make geopolitical change or climate action change?
It is true. I feel like that really gets to the myth, which I think is a myth, of the idea of why should we not make any changes because no one else is yet? Because all of these things are interconnected.
Definitely. And it's interesting because renewable energy to a degree is dependent on your location. Yes. Wind, solar, tidal, hydro, it to a degree relies on what your country naturally has, but not to the same degree fossil fuels did. It doesn't depend on whether or not there is literally oil under your ground. There's a lot more freedom. And I think there are so many downsides to being an oil-reliant country that the idea of not changing anything just because no one else is, to me, just doesn't make sense. You know, there's so many downsides to being reliant on somebody else for your energy and or continuing to rely on your own oil, that it just makes sense to me to shift away from the potential carbon curse and shift towards taking steps towards renewable energy.
Absolutely. I know. It was something that I was so surprised was missing from the mainstream media discourse. That this is not something that is going to solve this issue tomorrow, but that can prevent future crises like the Russian one, because I think what happens is it's so easy to pretend that that's not going to happen again, to wish for the best case circumstance, you know, to be willfully blind, however you want to put it. But at the end of the day, as long as you are vulnerable because you are relying on a potentially non-democratic country whose interests may or may not be aligned with yours and like may or may not be aligned with them in the future too, for your vital energy reserves upon which your economy depends, like that is a vulnerable place to be in. That's, you know, even if it's low probability, it's very high risk.
Definitely. And it's also something that, you know, many countries that are the ones that are able right now to benefit from a lot from significant oil industries are also those who are potentially going to be hit very hard by climate change. If you think about countries that are located in the Middle East, Northern Africa, they're all in areas where they're already seeing issues around water, around heat, around changes to the climate. That's not helpful in the conversation of climate change, but changes to the average number of days of extreme heat in a year, for example, is a more specific of what I was going for. But they're also the ones that are, so they're also so incentivized to make change, but in a way that doesn't translate to change in a rentier economy, because it's the general population that has that incentive to change, because they will be heavily impacted. But there's a disconnect from that population to those in power in a resource economy like this. And so it's also, I think, really interesting to see internally in these nations, in these states, what will happen when they realize that their interests aren't aligned too.
Yeah. No, it's, I feel like, you know, if our listeners are wondering what you do, it is the same solutions as before. It is, I think, reducing your own reliability on fossil fuels, on oil, on natural gas. The more energy independent your community and your country can be, the better, and, you know, the more leverage you have in the geopolitical realm too, and the less vulnerable you are to something like this.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it's tough because resource economies like this don't have to go badly. You know, there are a couple examples of countries that are heavily reliant on oil and have managed to avoid the carbon curse. There's examples of countries that, you know, for a while were looking really great, you know. Venezuela is another example where, for a while, because of the money coming in from oil, they're able to have one of the highest literacy rates in the world because they're able to fund their education system. And so it's tough to, like, because on the one hand, we talk about wanting folks to be able to have the skill sets to navigate climate change, to talk about it, to understand it, and high literacy rates support that. But there's also downsides to the resource economy that kind of countered that. And so it's interesting to think about the potential these economies could have had, but also because they're so susceptible to so many challenges and the challenges of human nature. And, you know, like I said, it's not just humans that are like this.
Wild.
Yeah. Wild.
The problem is complicated, but the solutions are still doable and less complicated.
Yeah. Be more like bacteria.
I think that's a good one. Yeah. How should we end it off, Leslie Ann? Yeah.
I think we'll end it off with, there's a lot going on in the world right now, and I hope this gave folks a little bit of a tidbit to help understand some of the conversations happening. But that's all, I think that's all we can do, is there's so much going on. This is our little contribution.
We hope you all are. Yeah, and it's worthwhile.
Yes.
It's a climate solution, and it is also a good thing to do for democracy.
Yeah. Learn things, vote, be prepared to try to cut your carbon footprint and do the best you can.
Mm-hmm.
And we hope you'll join us again for our next episode soon.